Hitler's War by David Irving. Part 6, Total War. Chapter is Trauma and Tragedy. Few events in World War II were to rouse greater controversy than Stalingrad. It would mark the end of German military initiative in the East, costing perhaps 200,000 German lives. It would explode the dream of the of empire which had fired Hitler when he came to power 10 years before. Far from being on its last legs, the Red Army continued to produce unsuspected masses of tanks and infantry out of thin air. Jodl was seen, white-faced, exclaiming, quote, "The Russians are stronger than in 1941," end quote. Hitherto, the Russian command had been wooden, hesitant, and bureaucratic. Now, suddenly, it was flexible, deliberate, and far-sighted, operating its tank forces as the Germans had in 1939 and 1940. The first word of trouble that reached Hitler was merely of two infantry assaults on the Romanian Third Army's sector. The Romanians were confident, even when a gradual artillery barrage did begin. No use was made of the Panzer Corps stationed in reserve behind them and commanded by General Ferdinand Heim. At 5 a.m. on November 19th, however, a colossal Russian artillery barrage suddenly began, and at 7 a.m., wave upon wave of tanks assailed the Romanians. They fought heroically. Three of the four Romanian generals were killed in enemy bayonet charges, and every Romanian company commander fell in the ensuing battle. A rout began at 10:10 a.m. General von Weichs's Army Group B ordered Heim, 48th Panzer Corps, to counterattack, but by midnight it was clear that he could not. He had begun the day with the 22nd Panzer Division, the 1st Romanian Panzer Division, and a battle group of the 14th Panzer Division under his command, but the 22nd was still exhausted from the battle for Stalingrad itself. The battle group of the 14th was removed from his control during the day, and the Romanian 1st Panzer Division had evidently abandoned the field of battle. Heim had no idea where it was. Weichs had hoped that the Romanians would hold the front long enough for Heim's corps to arrive, but they did not, and their flight barred the advance of Heim's tanks. He was further beset by freezing fog and rain, by sleet and snow. Weichs ordered him to go over to the defensive that evening. Hitler now clearly realized it as a major crisis. Although the general staff situation reports painted it in a misleading hue, by 9:30 p.m., he had authorized Weichs to abandon all further assault operations in the city of Stalingrad, so as to release forces to the main front line. He also ordered Field Marshal von Manstein to abandon the planned attack at Veliki Luki and to establish a new army group on the Don, thus relieving Weichs of direct responsibility for the two Romanian armies, and for the 4th Panzer Army and 6th Army at Stalingrad. During the night, he ordered Heim to attack again, but the attack failed. The Romanian army evaporated. From Bucharest came the most indignant sounds. Hitler ordered Keitel, quote, "Send for General Heim at once. Strip him of his insignia and arrest him. He is to blame," end quote. To appease Antonescu, Heim was sentenced to death some months later, but the Führer subsequently relented and commuted the sentence. Such were the shocking events northwest of Stalingrad. To the south of the city, a Russian bridgehead of equal menace spewed forth hundreds of tanks on November 20th. The enemy's preparations here had escaped detection until 2 days before. The eastern flank of the 4th Panzer Army withstood the blow, but three adjacent Romanian divisions crumpled with scarcely a sigh. By the 21st, it was clear that the two great pincer army arms of the Red Army offensive would join around Stalingrad the next day. It was natural that the endangered 6th Army should see its survival as depending on an airlift. When Hans Jeschenik, chief of the air staff, arrived at Berchtesgaden on November 20th from the Luftwaffe headquarters in East Prussia, he did not reject the idea. 100,000 men had been sustained in the Demyansk pocket for months the previous winter by such an airlift. In the afternoon, the 21st, In the afternoon of the 21st, Hitler therefore decided the 6th Army must stand fast, quote, despite the danger of its temporary encirclement, end quote. The railroad line was to be held open as long as possible. Quote, as to airlift, orders will follow. Immediate objections were raised. Richthofen phoned Goering, Zeitzler, and Weichs to warn that there were not enough transport aircraft. The 6th Army would need many hundreds of tons of food, oil, and ammunition each day. Hitler, however, saw neither nor sought any alternative. In his speeches of September 30th and November 8th, he had committed himself before the entire nation. He could not relax his grip on Stalingrad and the Volga now. Late on the 21st, he again ordered Paulus to hold on. When Hitler telephoned Goering in Berlin, the latter assured him his Luftwaffe would do all in its power. As he explained to Richthofen, quote, the Führer was optimistic. What right had I to be the pessimist? End quote. When he called briefly at the Berghof late on the 22nd, making for Paris on a shopping trip, he repeated this undertaking. It is improbable that he did so unconditionally, but then Hitler himself expected the encirclement to last only temporarily, until the damaged Army Group front had been repaired and the infiltrating enemy annihilated. Shortly, Paulus radioed that his ammunition and food stocks would soon be exhausted. Hitler realized that he could postpone his return to his East Prussian headquarters no longer. At 5 to 10 that evening, November 22nd, his train left Berchtesgaden station. For a whole day, he was confined to the train as it headed for the Wolf's Lair. Every few hours, the train was halted for contact to be established with the General Staff headquarters. As the train jolted on through the darkness, he and Jodl began elaborating a daring plan for the 4th Panzer Army to attack the encircling ring and relieve Stalingrad. It would take about 10 days to prepare. Zeitzler phoned him during the next halt, imploring him to instruct the 6th Army to break out westward before it was too late. Hitler rebuffed him, quote, we have thought of a new way out. Jodl will tell you. We will discuss it in person tomorrow, end quote. Hitler arrived back at the Wolf's Lair late on November 23rd. He found Zeitzler waiting outside his bunker and put out his hand to him. Quote, you have done all you could, he said as they stepped inside. With calculated pathos, he added, one finds one's true greatness in the hour of deepest misfortune, like Frederick the Great, end quote. Zeitzler was unimpressed. He reported that the Army Group Commander Weichs now shared his view that the 6th Army was doomed if it stayed put. Hitler thumped his desk. We are not budging from the Volga. A curious optimism prevailed around him, an optimism that has been effectively masked by the post-war alteration of the few headquarters records that survive. Helmuth Greiner, author of the OKW's War Diary, would falsify many passages in its published text. The printed version includes the following sentences in an account of a crucial argument between Hitler, Jeschenik, and Zeitzler on December 21st, at the height of the Stalingrad crisis. Quote, As usual, however, again, no bold decisions are taken. It is as though the Führer is no longer capable of doing so. There is no trace of these words in... Oh, that's the whole quote. There is no trace of these words in Greiner's original 1942 text. In fact, initially the situation was not seen as hopeless. Reserves were moving up, ready for the relief offensive that Manstein was to direct. Nor was the 6th Army's supply position as bad as had been feared. On November 24th, its quartermaster asked for 200 tons of fuel and 200 tons of ammunition a day, with an unspecified quantity of flour after the 27th. On the 25th, the OKW historian wrote that Paulus's demand for 700 tons was evidently exaggerated. Gradually, the figure of 300 tons a day was accepted as reasonable. The air staff was evidently optimistic, for twice the OKW historian noted that 298 Junkers transport aircraft were available, with a daily lift capacity of 600 tons. In 1945, Greiner would improve his 1942 record to read, quote, only 298 transport planes are with the 4th Air Force, but 500 are needed, end quote. One problem was that attempts to reach Goering failed. The Reichsmarshal was still shopping in Paris. In his fake diary entry of November 25th, 1942, and there's a quote, there's a asterisk related to that, so let's check it out. Asterisk says, regrettably published by the well-known Institute of Contemporary History, Munich. In his fake diary entry of November 25th, 1942, Major Engel nonetheless transplanted Goering into the Wolf's lair for a dramatic conference with Hitler that day. On November 27th, the OKW's note on Hitler's afternoon conference read, quote, enemy's dispositions around Stalingrad could hardly be more favorable for 6th Army's intentions. The Stalingrad food situation is better than we thought, end quote. On the 29th, the same record referred to Field Marshal von Manstein's appreciation of the situation. Quote, arrives at the same conclusion as Führer, end quote. This sentence was omitted altogether by Greiner from his published text. Manstein's opinion unquestionably strengthened Hitler's determination. On November 24th, arriving at Weichs's operation room, Manstein had emphatically rejected the general's judgment that Paulus had no alternative but to abandon Stalingrad. Obviously, a breakout was still possible and the quote-unquote surest way. Manstein's report said, but nonetheless, I am unable to share Army Group B's enthusiasm for a breakout as long as there are still adequate supplies, at least of armor-piercing ammunition, infantry ammunition, and fuel. This is vital, end quote. Manstein added that a relief operation would be possible with reinforcements being moved up by the beginning of December. At the same time, he radioed Paulus, quote, we shall do everything to hew you out there. Manstein himself was engrossed in planning the relief offensive by Hoth's 4th Panzer Army, but the forces at his disposal for this were steadily whittled away to buttress the Italian and Hungarian sectors. It was here that ever since mid-August, Hitler had expected Stalin's strategic push toward Rostov to develop. Richthofen uncomfortably observed, quote, it seems the Russians are going to attack the Italian sector too, a bad thing as they will probably run faster than the Romanians, end quote. Hitler, anxiously investigating the fighting capacity of the Italians and Hungarians, now observed that their provision with anti-tank guns had been badly neglected. He ordered this omission repaired immediately from captured French stocks. Manstein remained optimistic. On December 9th, Jodl's deputy dictated to the OKW war diary, quote, the Führer is very confident and plans to regain our former position on the Don. The first phase of the Russian winter offensive can be regarded as finished, without having shown any decisive successes, end quote. Hitler contemplated minor losses of ground in the East philosophically. To lose comparable ground in Europe would, however, be catastrophic. This was why North Africa, as Europe's outfield, was significant. This was why he was even now pouring troops and armor, including the very latest Tiger tanks, into Tunis. Thoroughly dispirited, Rommel disagreed with this assessment. On November 28th, he arrived unannounced and without the Führer's permission at the Wolf's lair. He hinted that Hitler ought to brace himself for the loss of Africa. Quote, we cannot hold on to Africa, he warned. There's nothing for it but to evacuate as many Germans as we can from Africa. End quote. Quote, what you proposed is precisely the same as the generals proposed in 1941 in Russia, retorted Hitler. They would have had me retreating to the German frontier. I didn't do it, and events proved me right. I won't do it here either. End quote. When Rommel described the desperate retreat that his men had fought across 800 miles of North Africa since El Alamein, and how his 15,000 combat troops had only 5,000 rifles between them, Hitler shouted that the troops had thrown the other rifles away. He ordered Goering to escort Rommel personally to Rome and get Italians to speed up shipments to Africa. He flatly disbelieved the field marshal's claim that he lacked the gasoline to stand and fight. Quote, a gigantic army drove back from El Alamein to here, commented Hitler, pointing to El Agheila on the map. They didn't drive on water, end quote. A few days later, late on December 3rd, he greeted General Hans-Jürgen von Arnim at the Wolf's lair. Arnim was to command a new army in Tunisia. From this bridgehead, Hitler planned to launch an offensive that would throw the enemy right out of Algeria and French Morocco. Arnhem's corps had been in heavy fighting on the Volga near Rzhev. He described to Hitler the fatigue and bravery of his troops, while Hitler nodded in appreciation. Hitler introduced him to Lieutenant General Heinz Ziegler, then addressed Arnhem again, quote, Herr General, you are to fly to North Africa at once. As you know, the Allies have landed here. He brushed the coastline with one hand. And I have decided to raise a new Panzer Army, the 5th, against them. You will be under Italian command and will work with Kesselring and Jodl, end quote. Ziegler was to be his plenipotentiary deputy. He packed the two generals off to Rome, whither the Reichsmarschall had already gone, at once. Goering's visit to Rome was not an unqualified success. He reported back to Hitler on December 11th, but he had evidently telephoned his first impressions to him some days before. Mussolini, he said, was wallowing in despair. He had advised the Germans to wind up their pointless Russian campaign as best they could. Hitler knew how precarious his allies' personal position was now. Air raids had inflicted heavy casualties in Naples and Turin. Clearly worried that Italy might make a deal with the enemy, he ordered Field Marshal Kesselring, Commander-in-Chief South, to start stockpiling maps of Italy in case Germany had to take over her defense. Hitler began planning a lengthy sojourn at the Berghof to clear his head for the fresh decisions. As soon as Manstein's relief offensive had begun, he planned to leave for Berlin, where he would see Laval, and then go south to the Obersalzberg, where he would meet Mussolini and Antonescu. Events in Russia, however, were to disrupt his plan. Before returning to the Eastern Front, we can review the possible sources of fresh danger that Hitler perceived in the Mediterranean, now that the enemy had secured a base at its western end. He deduced that if the Axis did lose North Africa, the enemy's next thrust would be into the Balkans. They would probably bypass Crete. The islands of Rhodes or the Peloponnese might seem more attractive, particularly if Churchill planned to rehash the old Salonika campaign of World War I. Since Germany's eastern campaign was again halted, Turkey's friendship had cooled perceptibly. Hitler therefore deemed it expedient to furnish fresh arms to the neutral Bulgarians to dissuade Turkey from any hostile adventures. His anxiety about Spain had also grown during December 1942. At first, he had turned a deaf ear on Franco's plea for modern weapons in case the enemy swept from North Africa into Spain or her African possessions. Hitler believed that the Spanish were too tenacious an opponent, and their country possessed too few advantages for that. Instructing the Abwehr to set up its intelligence activity throughout Spain and Portugal, Keitel, however, explained to Canaris, quote, The Führer is particularly alert as to Spain because Britain has already begun a stop thief propaganda campaign, such as usually precedes her own military operations, end quote. Hitler was in a quandary. His instinct told him that Spain would be neutral, but arms deliveries would be useless if they came too late. He therefore told Spain's General Muniz Grandes that he agreed to entertain the Spanish needs, provided that General Franco solemnly undertook to use the weapons to ward off any British or American aggression. Hitler could not understand why Britain was helping the United States. Quote, Any sensible Englishman must say to himself that Britain is going to have to foot the bill, end quote, he told the Dutch fascist leader Anton Mussert in December. Quote, We have not the slightest reason to fight Britain. Even if we win, we gain nothing from Britain. Britain ought to be glad to have in Germany a bulwark against Russia, end quote. The day when Germany and Britain would join to rise up against American imperialism seemed farther away than ever. Any uncertainty about France's loyalties was soon dispelled forever. Forschungsamt intercepts revealed the full extent of Darlan's long-planned treachery and even hinted that Marshal Pétain had been a willing party to it. General Weygand was already in German custody. Hitler ordered that General Maurice Gamelin, Leon Blum, and Edouard Daladier would have to be arrested too. When Heinrich Himmler came to the Wolf's Lair on December 10th, Hitler authorized him to extract the several hundred thousand remaining Jews from France as well. At Himmler's suggestion, those with influential relatives in America were to be held in special camp under conditions that will keep them alive and well. Quote, under conditions that will keep them alive and well, unquote. The spirit that had tempered Hitler's demands at Compiègne was dead. Apart from a possible later Falange Africaine to recapture France's lost colonies, her armed forces would henceforth be limited to an enlarged police force and garde mobile. Quote, the French police are good, acknowledged Hitler. We'll harness them. We'll work only with the police. Himmler knows his policemen. He employs the most reprehensible methods himself, so this will make them all partners in crime. It will be a police alliance, end quote. Hitler relished his private conferences with Himmler. The SS chief was always bringing something new. It was Himmler who was most assiduously propagating the new, quote, European, the quote-unquote European spirit. In the SS Panzer Division Viking, now fighting on the Caucasus, the young men of Scandinavia and the Netherlands were united with the finest German troops. Himmler was keeping potential dissidents like Halder and Braukitsch under discreet surveillance, and it was Himmler who had secured access to Hitler for the rocket scientists of Peenemünde. Quote, for your information, Himmler cabled his intelligence chief on December 5th, the Führer is very satisfied with our reports, end quote. In one of these, dated December 4th, the Gestapo announced the, quote-unquote, taking out of a major arsenal of the Polish underground in Warsaw. The four-room house harbored not only the usual quantities of explosives and detonators, but also, quote, three flasks of typhus bacilli, 17 sealed rubber tubes, presumably containing bacteria, and one fountain pen with instructions for use for spreading bacteria, end quote. A more enigmatic Himmler document is a letter to Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller stating that, quote, the Führer has authorized the transmission of such intelligence data as the OKW and foreign minister agree to in order to keep up the radio game with Moscow, even though this would normally be prima facie, tantamount to treason, end quote. It was the night of December 11th to 12th, 1942, for the first time in many months, Hitler's insomnia had returned. He knew that rumors were sweeping Germany that an entire army had been encircled by the enemy at Stalingrad. Manstein's relief offensive was slated to begin in a few hours' time, but there were grounds for disquiet. Goering had kept his promise by marshaling a huge armada of transport aircraft for the airlift, and yet the airlift was clearly failing. Worse, during the 11th, a Russian infantry attack had developed on the Italian 8th Army sector northwest of Stalingrad, though it was still moderate in strength, and although the terrain and their superiority in artillery favored the Italians, Hitler had steeled himself against the inevitable catastrophe the moment the Russians now began the main assault. He guessed they were only waiting for the Luftwaffe to be grounded by foul weather. He had ordered the 17th Panzer Division unloaded behind the Italian front. Although it might make the difference between success and failure for Manstein's relief operation if it now had to begin with only the 6th and 23rd Panzer Division in its spearhead. Was it the right decision? Between them, those divisions had 233 good tanks, more than the Russian divisions opposing them. Quote, we've got enough tanks, Hitler told Zietzler the next day. Jodl assured them both. He'll manage everything, meaning Manstein. It is just that the area is so vast and our divisions so few. The enemy just flows around behind them again. End quote. It's two different quotes for different people, but I think you understood. It was the sense of uncertainty that kept Hitler awake. If they had abandoned Stalingrad, the whole point of the Russian campaign would have been lost. Quote, we have shed too much blood for that. End quote. The campaign had now cost the German army 371,000 dead. 2 days later, Bormann had recorded Hitler as saying he would never capitulate. He would keep fighting even if he had to draft 14 and 16-year-olds into battle. quote, "It would still be better for them to die fighting the East than for us to lose the war and see them tortured and sold into slavery," end quote. It's good foresight. In his mind's eye, Hitler could already see the glorious moment 6 days hence when the siege of Stalingrad would be lifted. First a narrow corridor and the taut-faced columns of Manstein's troops disheveled from battle would come pouring through with food and gasoline-laden trucks bringing up the rear. In the city itself, the word would pass from starving mouth to mouth that salvation was there. This was the vision that sustained him. The uglier possibility was banished from his mind. He could not believe that Manstein would fail, unless, of course, the Italian front caved in first. He bitterly reproached himself for not having swept straight through Stalingrad that summer. Quote, "Things would have gone faster if we hadn't got bogged down in Voronezh," end quote. Lastly, he tormented himself with the question of whether or not he could now risk going to the Berghof to see Mussolini. Quote, "We will just have to see how things go today and tomorrow," he told Zietzler. Manstein's attack began well the next morning. An atmosphere of euphoria pervaded the OKW. Quote, "Little worry about carrying the attack through as the enemy's tank strength is strongly reduced," noted their official historian, and end quote. Hitler, refused to be led astray by the OKW's impatient optimism. Stalin was after a far bigger prize. He also wanted to cut off the retreat of the entire army group in the Caucasus, 500,000 men. On the 14th, the 6th Panzer Division destroyed 41 tanks. Soon the 17th Panzer Division, which Hitler had, after all, made available, would be joined to the attack. Already it was halfway to Stalingrad. Then, on the 16th, came the event Hitler had feared. As the Russians hurled three armies at the narrow sector for the Don front he had entrusted to his Italian allies northwest of Stalingrad. Two bomber wings were diverted from Richthofen's support operations for the relief attack to help the Italians. A diversion Richthofen labeled, quote-unquote, abandoning the 6th Army, it's murder. How well would even German troops have fought against such odds? After 2 days of plucky fighting, the Italians took to their heels, tearing an immense breach between Manstein's and Weich's army groups. The military calamity was not without its effect on Hitler's heart. Quote, sent for during the evening, noted Professor Morell on the data card, December 17, 1942. He said that Goering had told him he took a tablet of cardiazol, a heart drug, whenever he felt weak or dizzy. Wouldn't it do him the Fuhrer good if he suddenly felt funny during some vital affair? I'm having trouble reading. End quote. Morell advised him not to. Goering suffered from low something. Goering suffered from low, Hitler from high blood pressure. Quote, "One might burst a blood vessel," the doctor warned and reminded Hitler of the health crises caused by his blood pressure in August 1941 and July 1942 at Vinnytsia. Hitler now somberly asked Morell to tell him frankly if things should ever look black for him, as, quote, "There are some really vital decisions I have to take, end quote. He said that he had no fear of death. That would be just a relief for him. All he had now was just one upset after another, and no time that he could call his own. Quote, "I live only for the fatherland, for Germany," he pathetically told Morell. "There's no cure against death that I know, but if ever my condition should become dangerous, then you must tell me," end quote. Perhaps rather tactlessly, Morell decided it was time to disclose to his Führer the news that his heart was indeed seriously ailing. Quote, "Since he demanded always to be precisely informed by me on his condition, I referred to the presence of a coronary sclerosis, which is why I have been giving him iodine for some time now. Subsequent electrocardiograms have confirmed my diagnosis," I said. End quote. Morell offered the rather thin consolation that this was not unusual in hard-working people over 45. Quote, "As the blood vessels of the coronary artery contract," he added, one may get attacks of angina pectoris, end quote. For this reason, Morel always carried nitroglycerin tablets and Edesan around with him. Quote, by injecting glucose, he said, I am also doing what I can to strengthen your heart and to dehydrate the system. End quote. The Italian foreign minister, Count Galeazzo Ciano, encountered a forbidding atmosphere when he arrived at the wolf's lair at noon the next day, December 18th. His main purpose in coming was to deliver Mussolini's hypothetical question. Would it not even now be possible to reach a political settlement with Russia, a la Brest-Litovsk? Hitler patiently replied that this would be irreconcilable with his objective of Lebensraum. It was a false illusion for Mussolini to believe that Germany could ever abstract divisions from the East to ward off possible defeat in the Mediterranean. He sugared the pill with caustic references to the French. As the Italians left, Keitel instructed Admiral Canaris to keep an eye on Italy. Quote, even though it is not to be anticipated that she will defect. End quote. A member of Ciano's entourage inquired of the OKW whether the Italian 8th Army had suffered heavy casualties. He was told, quote, none at all. They never stopped running. End quote. With the collapse of the Italian army, a terrible new situation confronted German 6th Army in Stalingrad. Only two alternatives were left to it: to push a battle group southwest to meet the relieving panzer divisions while still retaining the strategic stranglehold on Stalingrad, or to implement Thunderclap, a breakout by the entire 6th Army, abandoning its tens of thousands of wounded troops to the mercies of the enemy. Zietzler put Manstein's case for Thunderclap to Hitler during the war conference late on December 18th. Hitler, clutching a bunch of colored pencils in one hand, watched the ominous red arrows of Red Army's offensive plunge ever closer to the airfields from which the Luftwaffe was mounting its airlift into Stalingrad. The logistic difficulties of launching Thunderclap seemed insuperable. Paulus demanded no less than 1,800 tons of food and 4,000 tons of fuel first, although the Luftflotte managed to fly in all of 270 tons that day. This was twice the average so far. By December 19th, the three divisions of Manstein's relief force had reached the Mishkova River, some 40 miles from Paulus's perimeter. The next day, one last push was made, only to be firmly blocked by the Russians. Hitler had ordered three more divisions rushed east from France, but it would take 3 weeks even to get them moving. At 6 p.m. on December 19th, Manstein radioed to the 6th Army in order to begin Operation Winter Storm, an attempt to extend the southwestern perimeter by a limited tank attack under General Huba, thus linking up with the relief force outside. Paulus was also directed to stand by for Thunderclap in case Hitler gave permission, but even Paulus referred to Thunderclap as a quote-unquote catastrophic solution. It was a heartrending situation, and one that the lesser commanders were glad to pass to Hitler for decision. He knew that Paulus's army was already tying down over 70 Russian divisions and brigades. If the 6th Army pulled out now, the enemy might move to cut off the entire southern front. Hitler steeled himself, therefore, against the noisy counsels of his commanders. Goering and Jeschenik supported him. Hitler refused to speak with Manstein, even on the telephone. Zietzler and Manstein nonetheless argued loudly that only the immediate withdrawal of Kleist's Army Group A from the Caucasus would release enough reserves to prevent a catastrophe. When Zietzler returned to his demand that the whole 6th Army be ordered to break out, Hitler irritably replied, quote, the 6th Army must stand fast. Even if I cannot lift the siege until spring, end quote. Zietzler accused the Reichsmarshal of lying about the Luftwaffe's capabilities, and he began to report the true airlift tonnage daily to Hitler each morning. On December 21st, over 360 tons were flown in, but now the two closest airfields had been overrun. General Martin Fiebig, whose 8th Air Corps was wholly engaged in the airlift, wrote, quote, one wonders whether the Führer has got the picture. whether he really knows the state of our men and their capacity for effort, and whether the Russian strength isn't being underestimated once more." End quote. This time, nerve alone was not enough. A year later, Hitler would explain his philosophy thus in a secret speech to his downhearted generals. Quote, "Let this much be understood. Nothing shakes me, whatever may happen. Some may think me heartless to insist on fighting to the last man just because the enemy will also let more blood that way, rather than to undertake this maneuver or that. It has nothing to do with heartlessness, only with my realization and conviction that this is the action to be taken. It is a matter of supreme indifference to me what posterity may think." End quote. Richthofen consoled the mutinous Luftwaffe generals with this argument. The Führer had been right before, and nobody had understood him then either. Quote, "Perhaps we shall all be chuckling over this crisis when May comes." End quote. Fabig, for one, was unconvinced. Quote, "Richthofen mentioned yesterday that entire armies were often lost without any effect on the outcome of the war. What can the Führer himself be thinking? What will the Russians do with this 250,000? They can but kill them. They haven't the food for them. Death will take a huge toll. Each man, one last bullet for himself." End quote. On December 27th, issuing instructions to the army for the coming months, Hitler decreed once more that Kleist was to defend his existing line in the Caucasus. The eventual liberation of the 6th Army must guide all other considerations. Thus, the town of Kotelnikovo must be held, too, as a starting point for that offensive. Meanwhile, the SS Panzer Division Viking would be moved up from the Caucasus and the 7th Panzer Division brought from France early in January. A new battalion of Tiger tanks would also be provided. That evening, December 27th, General Zietzler, the Chief of General Staff, arrived unannounced at the Wolf's Lair. Ignoring the adjutant's protest, he tackled the Führer in his private bunker. Hitler was moodily listening to records of Beethoven. The general spoke earnestly and ended with the words, quote, "If you do not order the withdrawal of the Caucasus front now, you will have a second Stalingrad on your hands." End quote. Hitler pondered briefly, then curtly told him, quote, "Very well, do as you wish." End quote. He regretted this almost immediately and telephoned the general staff's nearby headquarters several times to try to intercept Zietzler on his return. Eventually, Zietzler himself came to the phone. Hitler said, quote, "About the withdrawal from the Caucasus, wait a bit. We'll have another talk about it." End quote. Zietzler's voice came back, quote, "Too late. The order has already gone out." End quote. Hitler said, "Very well," and irritably replaced the receiver. He may have sensed that now a retreat from Russia was beginning that would not be halted at the frontiers of Germany. And that's the end of that chapter.